Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer, and we are not now going to Afghanistan. We're postponing that till a little later in the show when we can get a clean line. Instead, we're going to talk about the internet. Is Google making us stupid? Stupid spelled S-T-O-O-P-I-D. That's a question writer Nicholas Carr famously asked in The Atlantic in 2008. He answers it now in his book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And it's not good. Constantly distracted, unable to think sustained thoughts, cranky, addicted to our inboxes. Carr argues the internet, while providing opportunities to make creative links and plumb information we could never even find before, makes us all think miles wide but inches deep. We'll take your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 433-WNYC. Do you think the internet is good or bad for your thoughts? How have you noticed it affecting your life the way you think? Can you read a long book, a long article? Can you pay attention to a task for a long time? Give us your calls, 212-433-9692. And now joining us in studio is author Nicholas Carr. Welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thanks very much.
The title of your book, The Shallows, sounds like a pretty devastating indictment of how the internet makes us think. Is it really all that bad?
Well, there are some good things that we all are aware of. We have access to a whole lot more information more easily than we used to, and it's easier to stay in touch with friends and family members, and we've been enjoying those benefits now for more than a decade. But I think when you look at the evidence of how the internet is shaping our thought, you realize that we're losing something as well by being constantly connected, constantly distracted, juggling all sorts of information. And what I think we're losing are the quieter and I think deeper modes of thought, things like contemplation, reflection, introspection, the ability to read deeply and think deeply and just be attentive to one thing. So I think we're seeing a major kind of shift in the emphasis of human thought.
You spent a pretty significant amount of time in your book talking about how our brain gets rewired by different technologies. And you look first at the book and the clock and the map. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the themes of the book is that what I call intellectual technologies, which are the various technologies we use to think with, have always influenced the way we think and have even influenced the neural pathways in our brains. And so the map and the clock, you know, many millennia ago created a more abstract thinker because suddenly, you know, you didn't just get around by looking at your actual surroundings. You looked at this abstract picture of those surroundings. And similarly with a clock, you didn't just see time as a natural flow. It became this abstract thing, divided into seconds and minutes. The book, I think, and I spent quite a bit of time talking about the book was is kind of a unique information technology, so to speak, because it shields us from distraction. I think the great thing about the book is that there's nothing else going on when we open it up except the words. And our natural state of mind as human beings is to be distracted, is to keep shifting our focus, to watch out. You know, back when we were cavemen, you didn't want to get attacked or miss some source of food. So we're kind of naturally wired to keep shifting our attention. And the book trained us to pay attention. And I think it not only made a difference when we were reading, but even when we weren't reading, we suddenly had a much greater capability to shield, to filter out distractions and keep one train of thought going. The net and other related digital media, I think, has precisely the opposite of effect on from the book. It actually immerses us in constant distractions and encourages us to go back to that old and I think more primitive mode of thought where you just keep shifting your attention and shifting your gaze because you have all this new information coming at you all the time.
Last week, Clay Shirky was on the show. He's a professor of digital information at NYU. And he asked the question, who is really reading all these books anyway? Let's listen.
the idea that the 19th century European novel should somehow be restored to its preeminent place that it enjoyed in the first half of the 20th century is a completely separate question and, frankly, a lost battle relative to the question of how do we maintain focus in a world where we can now opt into as many distractions as we like. And one of the things I have consistently been arguing for is that the kind of retrograde concerns for Proust and Tolstoy, which had already passed out of mainstream society, are in fact a distraction from thinking about distractions, which is the real problem before us.
Can you respond to that?
I think it's more subtle than that. I think, first of all, to kind of somehow dismiss Proust and Tolstoy and all great literature as something that is now part of the past, and we should be happy about that. You know, I personally...
Well, in fairness to the... You know, we only played an excerpt of this discussion. So, like, to not just sort of jump down the distraction rabbit hole ourselves, you know, he wasn't really arguing nobody reads Proust, nobody reads Tolstoy. He was arguing that a certain sector of society reads Proust and Tolstoy and that there never was this halcyon time when everybody read Proust and Tolstoy.
I think that's absolutely right. As I said, I think it's more subtle than that because... It's not just about the book in printed words influenced us even when we were reading bodice rippers and stuff. It's not just about great literature. It's about the habits of mind that were encouraged and rewarded when we sat down and read a book. And it actually didn't matter necessarily what kind of book it was, because the habits of mind are the same, and the habits of mind are ones that are attentive, that filter out distractions, that allow us to be contemplative, that allow us to make connections in our own memories. So it's not just about great literature. It's about losing, and it's not even just about reading. It's about losing these, what I think are very important modes of thought, slower, quieter, more solitary modes of thought, because now we're not just, you know, using the net once in a while. We're constantly bombarded. We're constantly glancing at our iPhones and our Blackberries. We're constantly checking Facebook. We're constantly checking various web pages and Googling. There's simply this new technology provides no opportunity, and it provides no encouragement to slow down and exercise these very different, quieter modes of thought. And when we lose those, when we begin to lose those, we begin to lose, I think, a very important part not only of our personal intellectual lives, but the very foundations of culture begin to erode, because most of culture was constructed by people who actually could pay attention to something.
And yet, I just finished reading with my 8-year-old Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, which was 736 pages. This is one of the most successful book series ever, beloved by young people who grew up exactly in this age. So how do you explain that phenomenon?
First of all, I welcome it, and I wish that phenomenon happened more often. And I do think, actually, that younger children in particular are very flexible in their ability to shift between, distracting pursuits and to immerse themselves in a very long book. It's when you start moving into the teenage years and then into the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s that people are constantly being distracted. And I think...
Is there a difference here? I mean, I read long books. I read long articles. I also find myself challenged to stay with a specific task during the day. Do we have a straw dog here? Are we really talking about the ability to read long books, or are we talking about the ability to stay with a task for a long period of time?
We're talking about not just the ability to read long books, but the ability to stay with a task, the ability to follow one train of thought, the ability to hold a long conversation with someone without glancing at your BlackBerry or your iPhone. So it's this whole mode of thought. And if you look at the statistics, right now the average American is spending about 8.5 hours a day looking into a screen, cell phone, TV, computer, and on average about 20 minutes reading printed works. And that 20 minutes continues to go down. And in fact, for people in their 20s and 30s, it's 7 minutes a day reading printed works. So we, you know, there's no doubt we still have a capability to sit down, many of us, and read a book, even write a book once in a while. But if you look at the general trend in society, it's ever more away from the media that encourage attention and more toward the media that encourage scatterbrained, constant shifting of attention and juggling of tasks.
I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehr, and I'm speaking to Nicholas Carr. He's the author of What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Shallows, a title that has a sort of answer in itself. The phone number here, 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Curious if there's anybody out there who thinks the internet is good for our brains. And by the way, before we go to the phone, I just want to ask, what is it about that inbox that is so seductive? What is the center of our brains that is getting tickled that makes it absolutely irresistible to see who wants to talk to us at this moment?
Well, I think it's two things that psychologists and neuroscience have found, that we human beings love new information. We crave getting the latest information. And it doesn't matter whether we think it's trivial or important. We just want new stuff. And I think that again goes back to very early stages in the development of the human brain, when knowing everything going on around you actually tended to increase your odds of staying alive. So on the one hand, we just crave new information in these new devices we have. Certainly play to that deep craving. On the other hand, I think it's also a matter of that more and more of the information, and this is a shift over time in the nature of the web, more and more of the information has some social utility or social importance. We're talking about, you know, communicating something about ourselves, communicating with people we know, even if we only know them online. And so to drop out, to not follow all these trains of streams of information, is to feel increasingly socially isolated. And there's even pressures, I think, now, social, job related, to be always connected and to always be able to respond and very, very quickly. And you kind of there's a fear that, gee, if I'm not following all of this, I'm going to lose something in terms of my social life or my career or my education
and,
or whatever.
I mean, you do, don't you?
You do. And that's why, you know, the reason we're having this conversation is because it's an extremely compelling medium. If we weren't compelled to use it all the time, then the deeper effects wouldn't be very important.
Let's take a call or some calls. Nick from Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Greetings from Nick to a Nick here. I think that your analysis, as far as it goes, I mean, it certainly has some validity. On its face, I think it's obvious that there's something to it, what you're saying. But I think there's also a deeper way of looking at this, and I would make a distinction between involuntary attention and voluntary attention. Involuntary attention is what just happens to attract us because of the circumstances of our environment and the way we were brought up. And that would include, in an era of Proust and Tolstoy, if you're an educated upper-class person, the ability to read all that stuff because everybody in your circle was doing it and you were trained and it was a focus to do it. These days, or in the 50s, in the 60s and 70s, people would sit down and watch a TV set for 5 or 10 hours, and a lot of people still do. Our attention is sucked away from us in all different kinds of media, but it's still involuntary, automatic kind of, there's nobody really home there. And that can be watching the internet, reading or writing a book. What I'm talking about when I say voluntary attention, which is really rare, is the kind of thing people get into when they get into sort of esoteric studies and Zen Buddhism and even the Gurdjieff work, if you're familiar with that.
All right, Nick, let's get, you've put a lot there. We've got a lot of callers, so let's get a response. Thank you for your call.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction. And involuntary attention is what psychologists usually refer to as bottom-up attention, which means that we're shifting our focus. What's going on outside us is controlling our attention. And the ability to, you know, pay attention to that in that way is very important, of course. But then voluntary attention, which is more unnatural to us and more difficult to learn, is called top-down attention, because it means our brain is determining what we pay attention to and filtering out a lot of other things. And that has to be trained, that we have to learn that, and we learn it by paying attention. And this is what I meant about the book being a very rare type of technology that actually helped us develop top-down attention. So we could focus on a train of thought. And it wasn't just, you know, a Zen Buddhist clearing of the mind. It was an engagement of the mind with ideas, with emotions, and so forth. And we're having much less opportunity to develop those top-down, voluntary attention mechanisms in our brain. We're going back to being controlled by the bottom-up stimuli that are coming not only from the physical, natural environment, but through our various computer screens.
I would argue, though, if you read, say, Dickens, there's an awful lot in Dickens about this very process that you're talking about, short attention spans, people getting sort of distracted by glitter. This was way, way, way before the internet. So, I mean, there's sort of, I mean, how much do we know, is the internet encouraging this, and how much is this just a sort of an essential human phenomenon of the shiny, the new, you know, whether it's coming through the internet or through the traveling circus?
It's definitely an essential part of our mind, and that's what I mean, that it's more natural to be distracted. So people have always worried about distraction and increasing distraction. But what's important is not to say, oh, we've always worried about this, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, if you look at how we spend our days today, the typical person, it's now worse than ever. You know, media like TV and radio, we certainly used them a lot, we still use them a lot, but they were segregated during part of our day. Right now, we're getting media distractions all day long, a lot of us anyway, continuously.
Except that we do hope that people have their radios on all the time here at WNYC.
In our only listening, yeah.
let us take another call. Vera from Nyack. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I was interested in the conversation, and I was just wondering, what evidence do you have that these new ways that we spend our time with all the technology has actually changed our brain or changed the way it does operate? You're saying you have evidence that we're spending our time differently, but what evidence do you have that we can't spend it the old way, or that we, that our brain itself has now changed? And also, I just wondered, you have a certain number of hours that you say we're spending looking at screens, but what about all the reading we're doing on screens? People read whole books on screens. People do serious research looking at those screens. Couldn't that be the same kind of contemplative thinking that we did in a printed book?
Well, let me go with the first question, which is the evidence of what this is doing to the way we think and to our brains. And there's now quite a large body of studies, of experiments, that look at all sorts of facets of the online life, the digital media life. There are a lot of studies of, for instance, just comparing what it's like to read hypertext, the kind of text we see online with lots of links, versus linear text, old-fashioned book text. And what those studies point to is that our learning and our understanding and our comprehension is compromised, is lower when we read hypertext. There are similar studies of multimedia, which, of course, the web is a great multimedia system. There's all sorts of things usually going on a screen. Even if we're looking at text, there's ads and videos and audio and all sorts of stuff. Taking in information in a multimedia way reduces learning, reduces comprehension compared to focusing on one thing at a time. And then there's also the multitasking nature increasingly promoted by our online life. And there the evidence is quite strong that there's a big hit to our understanding, our ability to make sense of things, our ability to differentiate between trivia and important information when we're juggling a bunch of tasks.
On the other hand, I mean, I recently spent some time at Stanford University, and Stanford University encourages exactly kind of the sort of mental collisions that you seem to be disliking, distractions, interruptions, all of this stuff, they would argue, and, you know, a lot of stuff has come out of Stanford, creates the next generation of thing. It creates a new kind of thinking that you may perhaps be losing something in sustained attention, but you're gaining an awful lot of creativity and ability to synthesize information. Is there nothing good coming out of the internet?
There's plenty of good. We need both ways of thinking. We need to have lots of connections and to be able to skim and scan and have those collisions. But equally important, we need to sustain and maintain our ability To think more quietly, to be contemplative, to think in more solitary ways. And in fact, speaking of Stanford, one of the most compelling studies came out of Stanford by in a Stanford lab led by a guy named Clifford Nass last year about multitasking. And they compared people who do a lot of media and online multitasking with those who are light multitaskers. And they did a whole battery of cognitive tests. So it was measuring what was going on in the brain even when they weren't online. And the heavy multitaskers did worse on every single cognitive test. In fact, they even found that the heavier the multitasker, the worse that person was at multitasking. They were less efficient in juggling tasks and switching between them. So I think you're absolutely right that there's a great deal to be said for having a busy mind and being processing a lot of things at once. But when that becomes our dominant or even our only mode of thought, we begin to lose some other ways of thinking that are at least as important, if not more so.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Nicholas Carr. He's the author of What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Shallows. I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. Thanks to everyone who called. When we come back, we will go to Afghanistan and talk about what the discovery of rich mineral deposits means for that country after this.